This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Good evening, San Francisco. I'm Alex Smith. Radio EcoShock is approaching 2 years on Green 960 and Green 960 Online. I appreciate your continued support as we blast out the awful truth every Sunday night at 10:30. Tonight, we'll hear from another Californian and San Francisco city planner. Jeffrey Tumlin is a co-owner of a local planning company, Nelson Nygaard, headquartered in this fine city. According to Jeff, despite all the green talk and the occasional new bikeway, cities are still made for cars. That's the way the bylaws work. That's the way the development process works. And that's why we continue to lead such unhealthy and frustrating lives. Jeff Tumlin works hard to change that. He's developed station plans and guides for the BART mass transit system and transportation master plans for cities from Seattle to Santa Monica and Palo Alto. Tumlin has advised Portland and even NASA all the time looking for ways to make getting around a people-friendly experience. Last year, I got some great recordings at the Resilient Cities Conference in Vancouver, Canada. You heard people like Richard Register and Sam Adams, the mayor of Green Portland. This year, the Gaining Ground organizers were attuned to the troubles, calling it Healing Cities. I'm going to play you one of the best short speeches from that session. Jeff Tumlin is an award-winning transportation designer, Stanford grad, and as you'll hear, a fearless speaker about everything we don't want to hear. Find out how many cars it takes to make us fat, stupid, and dead. The introduction is by Rob Abbott, founder and CEO of Abbott Strategies.
Every now and then you get a chance to meet someone in a collegiate profession, and it just kind of leaves you going, wow. Jeff did that to me a while back. We were a few years ago, we first met, you got to love this, we first met in the desert on the other side of the world in Abu Dhabi. We were planning a region for His Royal Highness, the Sheikh Khalifa, I believe it was, for an area of the world that has 10% of the operating and known oil reserves on the planet. Now, you'd think that a transportation planner and engineer working next to 10% of the world's oil reserves, that'd be sacred ground. But for Jeff, he brought an entirely different approach to this. He started challenging that entire country to rethink how they move around. And that's one thing for us to say here on the temperate climates. But when you are in the desert in September at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it sits at around 50 degrees outside at about 100% humidity and blowing sand. And when you want to get people out of their cars to go walk somewhere, that is a formidable challenge. That's about the equivalent of getting people to walk to work in Tuktoyaktuk on December the 21st. It's a big challenge. And yet he was able to change the whole minds around entire cities and regions and how they worked. And that was where I got to see him first in action. Now, I've asked him a little bit about why his whole firm and he in particular take an entirely different approach than what most of us get a chance to work with when we're dealing with transportation planners. He gave me the following quote. He said, you know, we recognize that transportation is not an end in itself, but a means by which communities achieve their larger economic, quality of life, social equity, and ecological goals. So they work with their clients to define their goals clearly, find ways to measure how those transportation investments that they're going to have to make, how can they also achieve these other goals. And so when you deal with Jeff and his team, you end up talking almost more about urban design and land use patterns than you do about transportation because of the whole interconnection of those. We can't simply solve congestion issues, mobility issues by adding more capacity. We actually have to take a look at the whole system that is fundamentally part of that. And so Jeff is going to take us further into this link between cities, movement, health, and spirituality in talking about some of the work and the ideas that he's been engaging in. Please welcome Jeff Tumlin.
Thank you, Mark. So I'm going to talk about a lot of problems, particularly health problems that are rooted in the decisions that we make in all of our cities about transportation. Say a few words about how we got stuck in this predicament and talk about the benefits of active transportation and end with a few things that your cities can do. I have about 70 slides to cover in about 20 minutes, so we're going to move quickly. So sit back, relax, and put your thinking caps on. So why does active transportation matter? One of the things that I love about the health industry is they have really, really good data. And unlike my industry, they actually do follow-up studies to see how their predictive tools actually worked, and then make adjustments accordingly. And so in the United States, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta has compiled trend data about a whole host of diseases, including obesity, and tracked that over time. So in 1986, we can look at the darker states that have significant rates of obesity, 1991, 1997, 2000, oh, we have to change the scale in 2004, 2005, we change the scale again, time is speeding up, 2007, 2008, 2009. Obesity is a severe problem in the United States, and it is a problem that's rooted not just in diet, but even more so in activity, and that corresponds even more greatly with some of the diseases that are correlated with obesity and lack of activity, particularly diabetes, 1994, 2001, 2007. A third of adults in huge parts of my country diagnosed with obesity. Another delightful disease that is causing increase in affliction is asthma. And one of the interesting studies back in 2000, during the Olympics in Atlanta, like in the 80 Olympics in Los Angeles, the transportation officials there said, oh my God, transportation chaos, it's going to be gridlock, it'll just be horrible, nobody drive. And so as a result, nobody drove, and in fact, the freeways were empty in Atlanta during the Olympics, and the health professionals there actually went to all the hospitals and collected data about who came to the hospital and under what conditions. They found a dramatic drop during that period of no driving in asthma, while at the same time, there was little, if any, drop in other reported conditions of the hospitals. So driving results in asthma, and it also results in a whole host of other conditions. And while the newspaper headlines get us all afraid of, shark attack and plane crash and, some mountain lion attack or something crazy going on in our community. In fact, for teenagers, the number one cause of death among teenagers in the United States is motor vehicle crashes. And fourth among all causes of death in the United States, and more importantly, a whole variety of related conditions, cancer, congenital anomalies, heart disease, are all related to transportation factors, particularly the lack of active transportation in our lives. The social sciences have also started to track data that relates to transportation. In fact, created a name for an entirely new condition called road rage, which there are endless scholarly articles that describe exactly the array, the soup of toxic chemicals that our own brains produce when dealing with the unique stresses associated with driving. These stresses and these health problems are worse if you happen to be young or old or brown or poor, and particularly if you're old. In fact, one of the greatest problems that most cities in North America are about to face in the coming decades is the number of people who are going to be over 65 and who are stranded in communities where walking cannot be a part of daily life. The science of gerontology teaches us that the minute we stop walking, we basically start dying. It's a huge problem. And I don't even need to get into the whole conversation about the relationship between our transportation decisions and global warming. In California, about 40% of our CO2 emissions are transport sector, and of that, 70% is us driving around. So, what's at the root of all these problems? How could we have allowed the frog to be sitting in the pot of water while it's now at a full boil? Well, there's a simple answer, and it's this. Even though we know that sprawl equals death, that the fatality rate in our sprawling locations is 3, 5, in some cases 10 times greater, the traffic fatality rate, than it is in our more walkable urban centers. And that the lower density community that we live in, the more driving that we do, the fatter that it makes us, the more unhealthy that it makes us. And that the social costs of all of this are astronomical. In San Francisco, the public health department has been keeping track just of the actual hospitalization and healthcare costs of pedestrian fatalities. It totaled $75 million over the course of 5 years, just dealing with cleaning up, the physical cleanup of pedestrian-related crashes in one city in 5 years, during a period of time when the transportation department had had very little money to spend on pedestrian safety efforts. Instead, we're spending $75 million public money in the public health hospital in cleaning up after the fact. So, what next? Well, the reason for all of this is not because the market has demanded that we live in auto-dependent communities, but the fact that our laws require it. In nearly every city that I work, this one is a very unusual exception. It is illegal to create the kind of walkable communities that we know the market is demanding and that Hank has told us in the United Kingdom the market is absolutely demanding. And all of this in spite of the fact that every planning document that I ever read has all the good words in it. It's, you know, mixed-use neighborhoods and density near transit, reducing vehicle miles traveled, reduce CO2, promote walking and biking, blah, 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 motherhood and apple pie. And yet, when we go into the actual law, into the funding formulas, into the street design standards, into the nuts and bolts of the zoning code, this is what results. This is a walkable community because you've got a mix of uses up there, and there's a, you know, there's a pedestrian and a crosswalk. So we've met the goals of our general plan in delivering what we've required. And so we wonder, however, if perhaps there is a bit of a mixed message. So, what's the solution? Well, as our previous speakers have already mentioned, in fact, all of them, there's a powerful relationship between density and the rates of driving. And the sweet spot that occurs in our old streetcar neighborhoods, in townhouses, in the places where that still accommodate the car, and yet don't require a car for all trips. You don't need the density of Manhattan in order to have a walkable, healthy, sustainable community. Another thing that we've learned, and you'll notice the same shape of curve, is that the best thing to do to make walking and biking safer is to create more walking and biking. The best thing to do to make walking and biking safer is to create more walking and biking. In fact, if we, what is the statistic? Oh, yeah. If you double the rate of walking, you decrease your risk of a traffic fatality by 66%. Another important bit of research that hasn't been updated since Donald Appleyard did it in the 1970s is the relationship between how we do transportation and our community health. You'll notice in the top diagram from, this is from Donald Appleyard's famous book, Livable Streets, he actually interviewed every household on streets of varying level of traffic, and he found that in a street with a relatively light amount of traffic, still a fair amount of traffic, the people living on that block had three friends on that block per person and about 6.3 acquaintances. You increase the traffic, however, on a similarly designed street, and the number of friends drops to 0.9 per person and only three acquaintances. And more importantly, when he interviewed people in more detail, the amount of trust on the block with less traffic was extraordinarily high. People would lend their keys to their neighbors, you know, when they were on vacation, take care of their dogs and water their plants and so on. That didn't happen on the block with lots of traffic.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock every Sunday night at 10:30 p.m. right here on Green 960 online and Radio San Francisco.
We're back with more ideas for the Green City coming from San Francisco-based planner Jeff Tumlin.
We also find increasingly in the medical research that not only is exercise really important for a whole lot of cardiovascular reasons, but green exercise, outdoor exercise, even for short periods of time, is strongly positively correlated with better self-esteem, happier moods, and this is true particularly for young people and for people who are suffering from mental illnesses. Another interesting factor that I am completely fascinated by is a remarkable neuropeptide that our brain produces called oxytocin. This has been in the press a fair amount recently. It is the biological reason for trust and generosity and empathy. It lowers blood pressure, and it increases social behavior such as friendliness. In fact, it's so powerful that it's now being marketed out there on the market where you put this little spray, and I won't show the other images that are associated with it, but you can imagine that this ad is not for oxytocin, but it's a remarkable chemical in that the most powerful way that our body releases it is, of course, during sex, also during breastfeeding, but particularly with human eye contact. Humans are unique among animals in that the contrast between the white, the pupil, and the iris of our eyes is greater than any other species. We get an enormous amount of social information through human eye contact, something that I will point out can only happen on foot, in person, and at 5 kilometers per hour or less. The other way, however, that we release oxytocin in our bodies is through exercise, particularly walking and bicycling. So, if driving, the science tells us, makes us fat, sick, die early, poor, dumb, angry, and mistrustful, and if walking and biking makes us fitter and smarter, able to handle complex reasoning better, the science tells us, sexier, more loving, and more trustful, then why are we still designing our cities around this rather than this or this? If these were the design vehicle for our transportation system, imagine how much more healthy our cities would be and how much happier all of us would be. So what can you do? Well, the first place to start is to measure success properly, to make sure that everything that you care about in your community is defined clearly in a statement of goals that then follow through to related measurable targets and that have implementable strategies associated with them, and then most importantly, have quantifiable performance measures by which your city officials can judge whether or not they have achieved those goals. If something's just nice and can't be measured, it's going to be ignored. Step 2. Fix your street standards and your street and transportation performance measures. This street, in fact, basically all of your favorite streets in any city that you've ever been to, is likely illegal in that community. It violates every rule of proper street design, and particularly it violates the rules of safe street design. Look at the factors that you love about your favorite streets and make sure that not only are those factors legal, but that your city traffic engineers are required to design streets that you will love walking along. Number 3, rethink traffic mitigation. So one of the things that my industry does, spends a lot of time doing, it's our biggest moneymaker, is analyzing the traffic impact of new development. And we typically analyze the impacts of new development according to a single factor, intersection level of service for motor vehicles, by which we measure the seconds of delay that cars experience at an intersection. Not the seconds of delay that people experience at an intersection. So a bus with 40 people on it, those people are valued at 1/40th as relevant as a car with one person in it. Interesting way to look at things. So if you're looking at seconds of delay, the solutions for fixing traffic congestion are to widen roadways, to reduce density, to add parking, or best of all, to move the project to a more isolated rural location where there's not current traffic congestion. Of course, the implication of any of these is to worsen the very problem that we're trying to solve. This is at the root of the unsustainability of all of the practices in my industry, and it needs to change. Step 4, legalize walkable neighborhoods. The city of Vancouver is the best model to follow in all of North America. If your zoning makes it impossible for someone to reasonably walk to get a quart of milk, your zoning is unsustainable. Step 5, get smart about parking. This is an all-day lecture in and of itself, and perhaps the most powerful tool that cities have at their disposal in order to fix some of their sustainability problems and their economic problems in a very, very fast way. So some of the things that we talk to a lot of cities about, eliminating minimum parking requirements. We don't have minimum housing requirements for people. Why do we need minimum housing requirements for cars? Creating park once environments in our business districts where somebody can park their car once and do 6 different things. charging the right price for curb parking to make sure that there are a few parking spaces available on every block, in every parking lot, in every parking garage, to actually not use the Soviet communist method of allocating scarce resources, as we currently do for parking, but not for housing or food, and instead let the market work for us. And finally, manage your parking in order to achieve your city's larger development, congestion management, and other goals. And finally, step six, make walking a joyous and delightful part of everyday life. And Brent talked about beauty, Hank talked about joy, and I would talk about delight, because the most important factors of sustainability are these factors that generate love. We know from sustainability science that the most sustainable thing that we can do is to maintain what we already have. And things don't get maintained if they're not lovable. Make your buildings lovable, make your communities lovable, and create cities in which we can all love each other. In order to do that, you all need to be at the table when decisions are made about the built environment and be advocating for that humans matter, and that our health, our spiritual, our physical, our mental health all matter in decisions about the built environment, recognizing that the built environment is managed by dozens of different bureaucratic agencies, people in silos who are not talking to each other, people who have over-professionalized their work and have complex formulas designed so that you cannot understand them. You need to understand those formulas. The ones in my profession are really quite easy. What we do is not rocket science. We've got a lot of big words that try to obfuscate and make it seem like it's harder than it is. It's really not. You can all fix the problems in transportation that create these unsustainable factors. So the other critically important thing to keep in mind is that time is running out, and we need to move beyond platitudes and move beyond general statements about yay sustainability and instead get into the DNA of how our communities are built and funded and how the success of those communities is measured, making sure that human physical, emotional, and spiritual health are factored into those formulas. Rome burned while Nero fiddled, and we have the opportunity to lose an awful lot if we fiddle around with public health in our communities, and yet so very, very much to gain if we understand these factors and get them right. Thank you.
There you go, San Francisco-based city planner Jeff Tumlin calling for people-friendly transportation systems. I recorded that talk at the Gaining Ground Conference in Vancouver, Canada, on October 7th, 2010. Did you know that humans need eye contact to stimulate our brains and a couple of other organs as well? It doesn't happen at 60 miles an hour, but could happen on a bike or walking. That reminds me of the 70s counterculture author Ivan Illich with books like Tools for Conviviality. Illich claims the true trouble with modern society is speed. Nothing faster than a bicycle qualified as a real human experience in his eyes. People who live in walkable cities and live close enough to avoid the commute agree. There is a sense of a return to humanity, of well-being, once we knock out the risky, deadly, and polluting hours of commuting. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock. Please tell your friends, Sunday at 10:30, Real Deep Green Radio on 960 AM, and streaming live from San Francisco across the nation at green960.com.